RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
The surname Smith is the most common in the UK, with some 730,000 people carrying the name. But add to that the Christian name Paul, and the anonymity changes completely. Paul Smith has been part of the British fashion scene for over three decades, culminating in a knighthood for his services to the industry in 2002. But his journey started back in the bleak post-war years of Britain. Leaving school at 15 with no qualifications and dreaming of being a racing cyclist, he whiled away his days working in a textile warehouse. His evenings and weekends were taken up with his passion for cycling, but all that ended with a serious accident landing him in hospital for 3 months. But that stay was to change his life completely. Join me now to hear Paul Smith's fascinating creative journey. I spoke to him at his Covent Garden headquarters in London.
You were born in Beeston in Nottinghamshire in, I think, 1947, although...
46, some, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It seems to be 47, 46.
Oh, well, I'm all for 47.
Okay, so it is 46.
I'm happy to be a year younger. No, I was born in July the 5th, 1946.
And that means that, obviously, that was at the very end of the war. Last year. So your early life would have been very much centred in the kind of austerity of post-war Britain and all that that represented, i.e., very black and white, very few cars, motorbikes.
Yeah, I mean...
What was it like? Paint me a picture.
What's so interesting, probably sad, actually, is that I can't really remember anything about childhood at all. My memories of childhood were really started at the age of 11, when I got my first racing bicycle. I had a sister that was eight years older and a brother that was 11 years older. So I was almost like an only child. And I think, I don't know, but I only think that I can't remember much about it because it didn't have any punctuation marks. It was all just nice.
So what was it, what sort of background did you have?
I mean, just going to the local school.
Yeah.
Go to the infant school, then to the secondary school, not passing any exams ever.
Did you have any particular interests at school?
The only thing I can remember enjoying, really, was things like woodwork and metalwork. And I can't even remember particularly liking art. I know geography I liked, although in hindsight I was hopeless at it, but I was interested in it.
So you were kind of drawn to practical things?
Yeah, very much
making.
Drawn. Yeah, very much more to do with, I like making a stool or a bowl or a candlestick or something in working on the lathe, But that probably was as a teenager, actually.
Yeah.
No, I just had a mum who was very gentle and very, just was at home all the time taking care of the children, and a very lovely voice and very calm person, and my dad who was very charismatic and very lively and fun. And I think it's because they were fine together, there was no arguments, there was no big events, so maybe that's why I just can't really remember too much about it.
What did your father do? What's his?
He does. I don't think it exists anymore. He was what's called a credit draper, which meant that you sold clothes to people and they paid you so much a week. But it was
which
not
is very much a 19 post-war thing.
That's right. Yeah, it was very much of that. As I say, I'm not sure that it even exists anymore. He originally was an insurance salesman, and then that he built up what they used to call a round, which was just a selection of people that were interested in buying, and not just clothes, I mean, like things like sheets and pillowcases and curtains, and then paying, so much a week to get the clothes and the household goods.
Yeah.
And he used to go around every week and collect the money and talk to them. And I think that's why, also, because that was very good for his character, because he was so easy with people and so good at talking to people. I really hope that I got a bit of that from him myself.
Sure. So you left school at 15, which is the norm in those days, with no qualifications, probably with no ambitions. And from what I understand, it was your father who kind of pushed you into getting a job.
Yes, that's right. Well, I mean, he said, he said, do you want to go on to, at 15, he said, do you want to go on to further education, which meant the polytechnic, yeah. the local polytechnic. And I said, no, I want to be a racing cyclist.
Yes.
And he said, no, that's not a proper job.
Yes.
So he wouldn't let me do that. And he knew somebody who owned a clothing warehouse because of his yeah. job. He spoke to the owner, and I left school on the Friday and started work on the Monday. Well, straight in there.
If I recall, I mean, certainly from my own background, at that time, you know, I'm a couple of years older than you, but work seemed to be plentiful. I could go from one job to another. You know, yeah. one day I was stockbroker's clerk, next and I was working in a factory. You know, right. it just seemed to be, you know, yeah. like that.
Plenty. Well, I mean, I literally left on Friday and yeah. started on Monday, and you know, that was it. I was just the lad, you know, the runaround lad, going to the post office, unwrapping parcels. But that was terrific. In hindsight, because yes. it was so run in such a sort of careful way, this warehouse, because yeah. there was not a lot of staff, you know, and it was quite a big building, and you know, lights were switched off when nobody was in that room.
Yeah.
The paper from the parcels was reused on the opposite side.
Yeah.
All the string, the parcel was undone, you know, and you used the string again.
Yes.
And so, and old invoices were used as notepads, which I still do today somewhere. You know, my old emails get used on the other side as notepaper. So I think it was really, really great grounding, really, and especially when I opened my own shop, it was the fact that you understood about yes, opening somewhere at 9 o'clock and closing somewhere at 5 o'clock. And
so it was kind of, in a strange way, a sort of catalyst, maybe in a small way, but certainly from maybe structural and organisational, that sort of thing.
Yes,
what was to come many years later.
Yeah, I mean, it was like an apprenticeship in a way.
Now, you mentioned just now your love of cycling, and of course that was curtailed because you had a rather bad accident.
That's right, yeah. At the age of 17, I was out training one day alone. And, you know, I hit a car, which I think was entirely my fault. I think I just had my head down and didn't notice it, you know.
These would have been lightweight racing bikes. You were really into that.
Yeah, it was a lovely lightweight racing bike called a Paramount, and it was you know, I was taking cycling quite seriously, and so it was devastating for me because I broke my femur, which in those days was
pretty serious.
You know, now they seem to fix them in a very short space of time, but then it was and it was a compound fracture, so
yes.
it was pretty ghastly. And then you had to have your leg in traction with weights to pull your leg straight again and reposition it. So I was in hospital for, I think it was about 3 months. And
yeah,
I broke collarbone and a nose and fingers. And, you know, so I did quite a lot of damage. And during that period, I really grew up a lot.
Well, from what I understand, you know, as one says, often out of adversity comes something good. And you started to maybe your experience in hospital, but you started to meet people who had a different vision.
That's right. I mean, there was two things really. One, in the hospital, in the ward I was in, it was the accident ward, and Nottingham, which is my hometown where I was in hospital, was a big coal mining area. So there was a lot of coal miners in there that where they had roof falls and things. So and during my period in hospital, I think 16 people died in my ward. So at the age of sort of 17, that was pretty mind-blowing. You know, really focused your head on existence on the earth. And then there was motorbike accidents and me with a bike accident. So it was a pretty grim ward, and I did grow up from that point of view. And then some of the people I actually met and wanted to keep in touch with after I eventually got out, they just suggested that we had a drink in a pub in Nottingham, which I never used to drink, so I wasn't familiar with it. And they chose this pub, and we met there a few times. And then on about the third or fourth visit, I realised that the pub actually was full of very young people, and starting chatting to them, and realised they were at the local art school. And that was really the turning point, really, because I suddenly met people that were studying architecture, fashion design, graphic design.
So this was an area of your mind that kind of was awakened. You'd not been interested.
Well, my father was an amateur photographer. And he was the founder member of the Beeston Camera Club, the small town where I was born. And he used to take me up into the dark room. He built a dark room in the attic.
Really? Right.
And do all his own developing and printing. And And also, because of his character, he used to do a lot of trick photography and superimposing.
Really?
And things like that. So that was always real fun. And I learnt a lot from that. And so I got a camera as a young guy, an Ilford, Kodak Retinet, I think it was called, a little camera when I was about 11 or 12 as well, having a bike.
Okay.
And so there was that creative side. And, and also I used to go to lectures at the camera club and... I got to know somebody called Cartier-Bresson, not personally, yes. But I know of
sure.
this person.
So you were getting very visually.
Yeah, and then also my dad
stimulated.
Often used to draw, and he was very creative in terms of fun and jokes and jokes and things. So he used to draw on the back of an envelope, or just to if you're on a car journey.
Sure.
He'd get you to do doodle and things like that.
So when you returned back to everyday life after your 3 months in hospital, did you go back to the warehouse? Or
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But you...
I went to the warehouse, and then I met a lot of the fashion students, and one of the girls wanted to open a little shop in Nottingham, and her father was going to back her with the money for this shop. So she was going to design and make the clothes. And so I left the warehouse, and she employed me, and I found the premises for her. Because she said, "Well, I don't know. I can design the clothes, but I don't know how to run a shop." And I said, "I can do that."
So this is the little boutique that you
that I worked in.
That you worked
then
in.
Eventually
then
I opened my
you
own.
You open your own.
So this was this. I worked. So I went to work for her, and also was a big learning curve.
So was it then that your interest in fashion started?
It was really? Through the pub, really.
I mean, were you because kids of 15, 16, 17. Certainly start to, they zero in on clothes.
Yeah.
It was...
I think then it was so
music,
different.
Music, clothes and girls, it seems to be at that point.
But I think the clothes were so, fashionable clothes as such didn't really exist too much in the provinces. I mean, I had
so this would have been for you 60s?
Early 60s.
60s.
Early
60s. So it would have been, recollection,
it would have been 61.
Called the modernist style, before mods, but it would have been Italian.
Yeah, I had my first suit was probably in 1961, 62, and it was called a San Remo,
right.
The suit, and it was from the warehouse, actually.
Right.
And it was a three-button Italian
suit
that was based on all what you'd seen in Dolce Vita,
exactly.
La Dolce Vita and all that. Yeah. Not that I'd seen the Dolce Vita until a lot later on, but...
And was it sort of at the time when winkle pickers were coming in?
Narrow ties, and you put Brill cream in your hair and things like that.
So you then, a little later, you open your own shop.
Yeah, I worked for the lady for 6 years. And
yeah.
3 years into that period, I met Pauline.
That's
who
right.
was... I got very close to all the people at the art college because of the girl that I worked for.
Yes.
And so, I got invited to all the parties, and they all used to come down to the shop and hang out. And then one day there was a party, and I met Pauline... who was teaching at the college 2 days a week. She'd a trained fashion designer from the Royal College of Art, and she was married with two children, and she was teaching in Nottingham for 2 days a week because that was convenient for the school holidays, so she could have the same holidays as her children.
Yes.
So she didn't have to have a nanny.
Right.
And we met, we fell in love, and eventually she came to live with me in Nottingham and gave up a lot, left her husband and came with the children. And at the age of 21... I was still living at home with my parents. Then suddenly I had a lady from London, a child 5, a child 8, 2 Afghan hounds and 2 long-haired cats. So it was a bit of a...
It's a big responsibility at 21.
Huge responsibility and massive shock, but in a delightful way because, as you probably know, we're still together. And so, it was great. And that was obviously... probably one of that actual act of meeting Pauline is probably the reason we're sitting here now talking, because she's always been my sort of inspiration and she was my teacher in a way. I mean, not that I went to college, but because she was trained at the Royal College of Art in the 60s, late 50s and early 60s. it was still the time that they were teaching fashion in a couture way. So it was very much about handmade, the importance of quality, the importance of proportion and shape and how things were made. And that was just such an asset in hindsight, because there were a lot of good designers out there.
Yeah.
But basically, a lot of the clothes were really poorly made,
right.
And a lot would get sent to a department store in Paris or in New York and get returned because they were just
not
great ideas but really badly made, whereas mine were always okay.
Yeah. You know. So that first shop that you opened...
That was in 1970.
1970.
And it was a 12-foot square room that we called
and
a shop.
The clothes that were in that shop were designed by you or by Pauline or sourced? Or?
Most of them were from people that were young designers that we knew. And then there were clothes made by Pauline.
Yes.
Literally designed and made, physically made by her. And then, gosh, if I'd got some of those now, they'd be delightful to have because they were so beautifully made.
And the shop itself, I mean, I'm interested because, you know, all of your shops have a distinctive look, which I think is clearly a reflection of your own personal view of the world and taste and eclectic kind of idea. What was that very first shop like?
I mean, first of all, it was it came about because I was friends with the tailor down the road who had a shop, and I used to hang out with him every lunchtime and... Because I was so interested in tailoring and cutting, so he used to be doing cutting out, and I probably used to drive him crazy actually. But and then I used to observe how things were being made and cut, and I used to say to him, "Oh, I really want my own shop. I really want my own shop." And you know, then I'd try to find a shop, but then of course I had no money, so I'd probably got about £600 or something saved up by working on my free day, which was a Monday, doing all sorts of jobs to earn some extra money. And then eventually he said, "Look, just have this back room. I've got a back room. You can have it and call it a shop." And we devised a way of entering it through a little narrow corridor from a different street. And it was had no shop window or anything. It was just a room, 12-foot square.
What was it called?
And we called it Paul Smith.
You did,
because I'd been working at the other boutique, for 6 years for this girl. And so people knew me as Paul.
Right.
So it was just a very practical reason to call it Paul Smith. And so we managed to put a sign outside, and a sign at the end of the street, and rather pretentiously said, "Vêtements pour hommes." And it was only open on Fridays and Saturdays.
Oh, right. So really a little secret.
Yeah. And because I'd been to... Well, Pauline had been to a lecture by Edward de Bono, the lateral thinker. And he said many interesting things. But one of the things he said was, the job always changes you and you never change the job. And how I interpreted that was that the shop was... My little room was full of clothes that nobody really wanted because they were so specialised and so unique that even in London they would have been pretty special, but in Nottingham they were very unique.
Sure.
So I thought, well, if I'm going to survive from this shop, the job will change me. I'll have to start selling clothes that I'm not really that interested in and that clothes that will end up being similar to the clothes you can already get in my hometown.
Yes.
So I thought, well, okay, if I do lots of other jobs Monday to Thursday to earn a living because I've got this newfound family, and then open the shop on Friday and Saturday. And the great thing about that was two things. One was that Monday to Thursday I did so many different things like freelance designing, styling, fabric designing, and pretty grim jobs like, you know, driving a van around and selling suits and selling cloth and just... But the great thing about that was learning by doing it.
Yes.
It was a real apprenticeship.
Of course,
it was fantastic.
And so did you, I mean...
And then the shop was open Friday and Saturday.
And did it follow then that you started to study tailoring yourself at evening?
That's right,
classes.
Yeah, around that time.
Yeah. So and this is your reasoning. You thought, well, you know, the only way I'm going to really be fulfilled is to make my own clothes to the quality that I want to.
Yeah, because, and also Pauline and I had such clear ideas of the designs we liked.
Yeah.
And so wherever possible, we used to try and make clothes with a little Paul Smith label in.
Right.
And then because I was so interested in tailoring and because of the gentleman that rented me the shop.
Yeah.
He was a tailor. And then I went to a night school, and I was privileged to work with a tailor that had, was a military ceremonial
dress. Is this
dress.
The Savile Row?
He'd had worked in Savile Row, yes.
Lynn Croft and Kilgore?
Well, that was one of my freelance jobs that
right,
I did.
Okay.
Yes. That was a design job I did.
Right.
They were down in Kennington, and they were doing ready to wear suits.
Right. Okay.
So I was doing many, many things. I always describe it as the shop was the purity, that was the hand in front of your body, and the hand behind your body was all these things that just paid the rent and you learnt from, and there were
means
experiences.
To an end.
Yeah. So the great thing about Monday to Thursday was that I didn't have to compromise with this little shop.
Right.
And eventually this little shop, because of no compromise, people heard about, and we used to come from Sheffield or Leicester or eventually from London to, there's this chap called Paul Smith, and he's got this shop, and you can get, you know, shirts that are all handmade and hand-embroidered. And I used to sell quite a lot of the music industry.
I'm sure, yes.
And so it sort of became like this little unique oasis of special things. And, of course, I was travelling to London Monday to Thursday, so although they weren't coming to the shop, I'd put like 3 shirts in the car, and then because of my personality, I'd say, oh, you know, I'm doing these shirts, are you interested, to somebody, and they'd buy one, and, you know, so it was very sort of hand-to-mouth, really. But
then, Little Ledger, in 1976, you design your first collection, which you showed in Paris.
That's right.
And so that must have been a real pivotal moment.
It was, yeah. I mean, and I'd been working for a shop in London for as one of the freelance jobs. I'd been working for a shop in London called Brown's, which is in South Moulton Street in London. And they sell all the sort of main labels from around the world. And also they'd employed me to do design and style for them with their own label, Brown's label. And during that period, I'd got to know quite a lot of the buyers from department stores in America and different in Japan and little boutiques around the world. And so when I started my own collection, which actually Pauline designed the first 4 years worth. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously I helped chose the fabric, but I was more of a sort of do a bit of everything man, and Pauline was the designer.
Right.
So when I first showed my tiny little collection in Paris, I used a lot of the contacts that I'd made through Brown's. I used to ring up, you know, the buyer from department store in New York and say, do you remember me? I'm Paul, who used to work for Brown's, and I've got my own little collection if you want to come and look. And basically nobody did to start with. And then the first time in Paris, one customer came on the final day. I was there for 4 days selling from my bedroom.
Right.
So I didn't have a showroom. I just, the little room in the hotel where I was sleeping, I put some sort of black felt on the bed and laid out the things and sat there for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and nobody came. And eventually at 5 o'clock on Thursday, actually 2 customers came, one from America and one from France. And they bought something. So that was a start. And then it wasn't really until 77 that, you know, eventually people started to sort of be a little bit interested in what I was doing.
And when did it sort of really sort of kick off for you?
It never really did. It's always been very gentle.
Yes.
And I think that's, touch wood, why it's been long.
You know,
it's had longevity because it's never been a flash in the pan. It's never been a sudden rocket, you know.
So it's kind of incremental, sort of organic.
I mean, you know, in 80, we... You know, in 79, I mean, these are all false figures, but let's say in 79 I did £2,000 and in 80 I did £3,000. Yeah. You know, so but it wasn't sort of 2,000 and then 20,000. So it never was like a rocket. And it was always based on the hand in the front and the hand in the back, which means that the hand in the front was the purity of the shop in Nottingham and the collection, the tiny collection, with no compromise. And the thing that really nobody knew about that I was doing was just all the other freelance jobs which supported me.
Would you say that you were a kind of cautious person, really, in terms of evolving a business.
I was
so many people go crazy and borrow masses of money and
we've
expand.
Never really borrowed money, see. Yeah. We're quite unique and we don't have any borrowings at all.
Yeah.
And we own this building where we are and we own all our warehouses. So we've always been very practical, I suppose.
And
I don't think we've been... I'm not sure whether cautious is the right word. I think it's... You know, a lot of it, I think, is because I've always been fortunate to have Pauline.
Yeah.
We're still very in love. We're still very solid together. Mm. We still inspire each other. Mm. So, you know, you're never really searching for anything particularly like, oh, I really want to be famous or I really want to be rich. Or
I think that those sort of relationships, those unique relationships, which I think are very rare, where you have not only someone that you're in love with, but you have a soulmate and an intellectual, you know, partner is a real rarity.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm sure in your case it must have been a tremendous asset.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. She's the reason for me sitting here now. Mm. Absolutely. I'm hardworking and I've got my talent, but you know, it's just that stability, that the fact that she notices things, and she's critical but in a gentle way, and she's nearly always right, you know.
Mm. Well, that's good to have that honest sounding board, because
absolutely.
I'm sure in your position, as with many others who've got to, you know, the status and level, getting an honest response from people around you is probably very difficult.
I mean, so many people in every industry, not just creative industries, are surrounded by subservience when they get to a certain point of their career, and it's so dangerous.
Yeah.
And certainly in fashion, probably in other areas as well, they surround themselves with their personal assistants and their assistants, and they're in their ivory towers and their chauffeur-driven cars, and then, you know, they're not replacing, they're not getting the new young customer, they're only taking their age group along with them, and then they suddenly look behind them and there's nobody there, you know.
Well, as an aside, I saw that documentary on Versace recently, which I think is a pretty good insight into that extreme.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, but
it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, over all those years, you've built up an enviable global presence, really. I mean, obviously London, Nottingham, of course, you've been very faithful to Nottingham, Paris, Milan, New York, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, the Philippines, Korea, Kuwait, the Arab Emirates, and you've got over 200 outlets throughout Japan. Now, Japan has always embraced British fashion, or certain British fashion, I think classical. Why do you think that is? What is it about the Japanese that...
Well, I was in 82, I was invited to go there by... There was a Japanese scout, I think they called him. He basically was a freelance man who worked for big companies in Japan, and he was in Europe to look for new talent. Mm. And he selected one from Italy, one from France, and one from Britain, and I was the one from Britain. And in the end, the company that chose me, I was invited to go out to Osaka. And I think why it worked for me was the fact that I was so humbled by the invitation and to go to this place called Japan, which I'd never thought I'd ever go to, because it was costly, it was far away, it was mysterious. Mm. At that time, a lot of other designers were being invited to go there from Europe and from America. But in my opinion, a lot of them were very disrespectful to the invitation, because they just thought it as a money-making thing.
Mm.
And that you just, you go, you sign a deal, you earn some money, you send a few designs twice a year, and mysteriously, you make tons of money.
Yeah.
And many brands and many designers went and opened the Japanese were very wealthy at that time, and they were on this high, and money was being thrown around very easily. And, so a designer would go and they'd open 10 shops and they get all this press and publicity, and then 4 years later they'd be gone. Whereas I went, and first of all, I was with an Osaka-based company, not a Tokyo-based company.
Yeah.
The other thing was they only made tailoring. They'd never made shirts, knitwear. They'd never opened shops. They never advertised. So they were I was so fortunate that they were completely the wrong company. And because they were the wrong company, and because I was so willing and so by that time quite experienced, and so willing to go 2, 3, 4 times a year, which other designers didn't do at all.
Right.
And I was willing to go economy, and I was willing to stay in a basic hotel, yeah. and I didn't want to chauffeur a different car.
Yeah.
And we built it together. You know, we built it because I rolled my sleeves up and I really taught them about shops, about showrooms, about advertising, about PR. And I, because of my personality as well, I got to know quite a lot of people eventually in Tokyo that were young stylists working for magazines.
Right, okay.
And they just liked what I did. And so therefore it all gelled. And I've been going, you know, I've been 80-something times, and I've got...
Well, I saw a documentary, and I think you were in Japan, and you were talking to
a classroom,
which is actually very touching, because I wondered whether you did that often, you know, sort of telling your story, basically, to a lot of...
Yeah,
know.
I mean, I tend, at least once a year, I try to do a lecture at one of the schools there, and last time I actually did it in a public place. I was asked to do a talk in a famous No theatre here, which nobody had ever used it ever before, apart from the theatre.
Right.
So that was quite a privilege, and it was a real sellout. I mean, it was fantastic, very exciting, and very humbling. You know, and
they do seem. I mean, certainly that documentary, the kids in that school were incredibly appreciative and dignified and, you know.
And I think it's very much about the fact that I've always been down to earth and very able to communicate in a simple way, in simple sentences.
Yeah.
I mean, I get quite a lot of students come here to the room where we are now, to the studio where I work, and it's quite interesting. And I had a group from Austria, and we sat down, and there were about 30 of them. And it was quite embarrassing because they got two of their lecturers there as well. And one of them said in front of everybody, he said, "I've learnt more in 45 minutes than I have 3 years at college." And I said, "Well, I'm really sorry about that," to the lecturers. And then it turned out really that it was just that the language was simple.
Yes.
It wasn't about conceptualizing the market research, or you know, the there were just kids who just said, "Well, how do you order fabric?"
Yeah.
Or, you know, that just very...
I totally agree. I mean, you know, we live in an age that's kind of steeped in jargon.
Mm.
You know, everyone's moving forward and using all of these phrases.
The bottom line,
all
and ring
that.
Fencing. And
it is depressing. I probably know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. How do you differentiate between work and home life, or are they seamless? I mean, how does it...
I mean, the work, honestly, is not work to me at all.
Yeah.
It's just a joy and a delight, and I'm very privileged from that point of view. And because I'm the boss, and because we have no, you know, sort of heavy shareholders that are demanding more and more and more all the time, you do have the opportunity to be very spontaneous and very relaxed. And then with home life, I mean, it's very much about Pauline and us. So I don't really talk about work at all.
Pauline, you said earlier, still is a kind of sounding board, but is she, you know, more involved in any way?
She was the other shareholder.
Yeah.
And then about 3 years ago, she... And my financial guy, they asked if I'd be willing to let them sell their shares, because they both got family that they wanted to sort of take care of in terms of flats and houses and things like that. And so I agreed to that. And then my Japanese partners are now the other shareholders. I've got the 60%. Pauline's not involved anymore. She pursued her love of art, so she paints. She went to Byam Shaw School of Art, and then she went on to the Slade School of Art. And she's got a studio at home. But, I mean, she doesn't say anything, and then she'll just say one thing that is so correct. So, you know, she's still there without her even probably realising she's still there.
Well, you mentioned, you know, art, and a thing I've noticed over the years about your shops. You always have a lot of art in the shops, you know, maybe 1930s, 20s, you know, as in the Flora Street one.
Yeah.
We're surrounded in this building, your building, with so much art. Obviously, you're a great collector.
I gave a very foolish answer recently at a talk when it came to question time at the end, when somebody said about my passion of collecting, and I said, well, actually, I'm not really a collector. I do have a large quantity of the similar or same things, but, oh, that is a collector, isn't it? That's right. Yeah. And what I meant was that I do, like, for instance, I've got a lot of art, or I've got a lot of objects or silly toys or robots,
yes,
but I know nothing about them.
Yes.
That's what
they
I
just
meant.
Appeal to you. They just,
yeah. And that goes back to that word, spontaneous.
Yes. And there is a, certainly I remember in the earlier days when you had lots of these tin toys and things, yeah, always, there's a kind of a slight nostalgia to a certain extent.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think there was
more of a nostalgia. Yeah. I think there's less of one now.
Yeah.
I think in the beginning it was just I like the idea of mixing very modern clothes,
yes,
with, you know, a sort of a collection of old corkscrews,
yes,
or penknives or
well,
something
your window
like that.
Displays are always very minimal but very witty. I mean, the one I saw yesterday where you've got a T-shirt in one window in blues and, you know, broken paint lines, and then in the other you've got a can of Dulux
paint
in a very lovely sort of blue,
yeah,
sort of a Yves Klein blue.
That's
and
right.
And it's very witty, and I wondered, you know, how many people, you know, get that.
I know. I mean, I think our windows are really brave.
Yeah, they are.
Because, you know, often, I mean, we've had, often they have hardly any clothes or,
yes,
no clothes. And I mean, and those windows are across the world as well. So, you know, we are pretty brave. I mean,
yes,
when with all the rain we had a window recently where on the window it just says, due to, it just was a post-it note with no clothes. It says, due to inclement weather, we've all gone to the Cayman Islands. So, brave. But, I mean, the art and the collections, I think it stems back to my curiosity. I'm,
yes,
a very curious person.
Yes.
I'm very childlike in my,
yes,
approach to things, and I like that. I don't clutter my head. I don't use the internet all the time.
Or, no.
I'm very free. So,
although you do have a blog for Vogue, I noticed.
Yeah, and for Paul Smith as well, Smith blog.
And you comment on exhibitions and pieces of art or,
yeah,
photography or things that have.
But that's just
you.
Stuff I know
just
in my head.
You unload it,
yeah,
onto that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and my own blog as well.
Yes.
Which is, yeah.
Yes.
But I mean, in terms of looking on the internet all the time,
yeah,
I don't do that. And also because of, I think the problem is that when you're so full of educational information, it sometimes stops you from seeing, and, mm, and you become too considered.
So but, how do you sort of unwind or refresh or?
Well, hopefully I never wind up.
You never
and
wind
so
up.
So it's the opposite, really.
Yeah.
It's just because I'm not really, I never lose my temper and I never have arguments. And I mean, I've lost my temper 3 times in my entire life or something. You know, so you don't really need to unwind because you never really wound up. You know.
You said of your own approach to fashion, I give classics just a little kick. Do you still maintain that that's what you do?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's, you know, it's,
yeah,
just,
little
it's just
quirky buttons or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think that comes from the fact that I was never really trained as a designer. So my work at the beginning, obviously I'm more mature now in terms of a designer, but in the beginning I only really knew how to do classical clothes, really,
yeah,
you know, simple,
yes,
a shirt that
the
looked like a shirt,
though, yes.
So, you know, so the trick was to make a purple buttonhole or 3 different coloured buttons or something, or the inside of the collar to have flowers on it, because that was my way of being a designer rather than you know, cutting an unusual shape or a strange collar or something.
Sure.
So it was always classic with a twist, really.
Now, you have, from what I gather, 12 separate collections. Obviously,
that's right.
They vary, but I mean, that's an enormous
big work,
know, discipline.
Load.
I mean,
yeah,
most fashion designers are struggling to do their 2 collections a year.
Yeah.
You know, so how does that work with your team and with you?
Well, as you say, it's 24 collections a year. So basically, the design floor is across the corridor and on the next floor below,
mm,
and I'm here, and then we literally already this morning I've had,
yeah,
2 meetings, so I'm just meet the assistant designers constantly,
yeah,
And I kick off the new seasons with, I'm thinking of, you know, the great Rothko exhibition I just saw. I love those deep, rich colours. So I want you to work around deep, rich colours. Yep. And then for this one, I want to work around, you know, each one has got a loose theme, but not a very strict theme. It's only a theme, really, or an inspiration just to help guide them through the early stages. And then we just see each other constantly, and then we, you know, it's a matter of I think that's really good, but we should not do that in that tweed, we should do that in satin, and it's just a conversation constant, really.
Now, I mean, a lot of fashion designers over the years have moved into, you know, home products.
Yeah.
I mean, in a sort of bigger or smaller way, is that an area that sort of interests you?
I mean, we've done quite a lot of other things apart from just clothes.
Yes, you've done chairs.
Yeah.
I'm thinking on a bigger scale, you know.
It's not something, for instance, homeware, we're not really that interested in it. We tend to do things. I mean, we get asked to do things constantly, like hotels and cars and phones and, you know. And because I've got this very strong instinctive sort of way about me, I just know straight away, yes, I want to do it, no, I don't. Or I might meet the person once and I just think, do I like the way this person is describing the project, because I can read into the fact that it's going to be a nightmare, it's going to be lovely, it's going to be dreadful, it's just going to be too pretentious or too...
So do you have companies coming to you who want to buy into your label?
Very much so,
and say, we've got this product, would you endorse it?
Constantly.
And is that something you tend to...
Well, it's just instinct straight away.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been working with this company from Denmark called Stelton, who been reworking the Arne Jacobsen designs.
Yeah.
He designed this line called Cylinder Line, which they make their stainless steel coffee pots and sugar bowls, and it's their 50th anniversary this year.
Right.
And Stelton asked me if I would give it a new lease of life, really, which I was just so shocked and humbled by. It's brilliant.
Yes.
Because I mean, out of all the product designers in this industrial designers they could have asked around the world, and they asked me.
Well, that's great.
Which I didn't know anything, you know, like I'm a fashion designer, so
I think that's an inspired choice, because you know, why go to a product designer?
What was obviously, I was really delighted but slightly nervous, because Jacobson has always been one of my heroes, and I thought, well, what on earth can you do to something like that, and people are going to get really angry with me if I you know try to twist what the man's done. So in fact, what I did in the end was I just added color, which is what I'm famous for anyway. So you know, just the handle of the coffee pot was just suddenly available in 12 colors instead of just black, and luckily, it's been a really huge success.
Well, that's great. There's a sort of connection going right back to that moment when you had your accident and your passion for cycling, because you've been in recent years designing cycling clothes for
Rafa.
Rafa.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
They're a company. I mean, that was what's so interesting. I could have designed cycling clothes for really huge companies, but it didn't appeal to me. But Rafa are such purists, really nice people, and you're very, you're very proud to work with them. So it was just a sort of instinctive thing straight away, you know. And what's been great about Rafa is that, you know, we're just doing it very gently. We're not like doing a Portsmouth collection. Yes. We're just doing, you know, two jackets, one hat, and then if it works, it'll be a bit bigger and a bit bigger. So
I noticed cycles in the building.
Everywhere.
Are you still cycling?
I am, yes, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, we've come to the end. I just wanted to ask you, really, what sort of advice would you give any young, I don't know, not so much these days, 15, because people don't leave school at 15 anymore, but young kids who want to follow in the world that you now inhabit, what sort of advice would you give them? I know it's always a difficult one. But
well, the point is that nobody needs another designer or another restaurant or another car or a car design. You know, nobody needs these things. You know, we don't need them. But we all like them and want to meet new ideas and that. So it's just a matter of saying, well, if how do I make an impression? What's my point? You know, so as a fashion designer or any designer, is if there's so much product out there, what's the point? And when I started, the point was that you could buy a plain white shirt, but it suddenly had three different coloured buttons on the sleeve, which has obviously been imitated by masses of people now. So, but there is often a way of doing something which is just eye-catching, interesting, special. So try and analyse what your point is, and you can do that by looking at your heroes and looking at the people that inspire you and maybe using that as a starting-off point and then seeing how you can rework, a bit like I did with Arne Jacobsen, something that already exists, obviously not copying it, but reworking it. And the other thing is the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday story, which is learning by doing it. Yes. And so just work in a bar, work in a clothes shop, work in a product shop. Just get out there as a young person and learn. Because even if you work in a bar, you say, well, why work in a bar? You know, I want to be a product designer. Well, if somebody comes in at 6 o'clock at night and wants a gin and tonic and there's no ice because you've forgotten it's left in it, you've left it all in the cellar, then you're silly.
Yes.
So, you know, just working in a bar, getting organised, making sure all the shelves are filled, the lemon's there, the ice is there, that you know how to talk to people, you know how to deal with situations. It's all a learning curve.
Yeah.
So just get out there and do it.
So it's really learning life.
Learning by doing it.
Paul Smith, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It was really lovely.